This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another new episode of New Books in Islamic Studies, which is part of the New Books Network. My name is Shobana Xavier, and I'm one of your co-hosts of this podcast channel. Thank you so much for joining us today, and I hope you are well wherever you are. In this groundbreaking work, Dr. Michael Sells, the Barrows Professor Emeritus of History and Literature of Islam and Professor Emeritus of Comparative Literature at the University of Chicago, translates 61 poems that form the Tarjuman al-Ashwaq, or Translator of Desires, by Muhyiddin Ibn al-Arabi. The book is published with Princeton University Press in 2021. The poems are presented here both in Arabic and English and are accompanied by an introduction and commentaries in the appendix. The masterful and accessible translations are truly a thrilling literary experience. Ibn Arabi's poems evoke numerous themes such as the flora and fauna, nature, sacred spaces, especially of the Kaaba, love, longing, and grief. For instance, the longing of a lost beloved, which Sufis would have read as the divine, is centered and also gendered as feminine. The collection of poems, along with Sells' important introduction and notes, provides stunning insights both to the tradition of Arabic love poetry, but also of mystical thought and the poetic prowess of Muhyiddin Ibn al-Arabi. This collection of poems will be of interest to anyone interested in Arabic poetry, Islamic literature, Sufism, and much more, and perhaps just the right gift for those friends or family members of yours who enjoy poetry. In our conversation today, Dr. Michael Sells shared with us his translation processes, what some of his challenges and the joys. He also helped situate for us the life and legacy of Ibn al-Arabi and his poetry, along with the controversy that surrounded the Translator of Desires and its legacy. Dr. Sells also guided us through some of the poetries, truly a moment to experience the masterclass of studying with Dr. Sells. And he introduces us to the themes of some of the poems, such as nature, sacred space, love, and longing, as well as the sources and authors that Ibn al-Arabi is also gleaning from, or the active intertextuality that Ibn al-Arabi is participating in. So if you have access to the book, you could follow along as we read the poems and discuss them. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Dr. Michael Sells of his translations of Ibn al-Arabi's Translator of Desires. Hi, Dr. Michael Sells. Thank you so much for joining us today. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm very excited to have you here to speak to you about your new translation of Muhyiddin Ibn Arabi's poems, The Translator of Desires, on our podcast. We have a tradition on our podcast to start our conversation with something a little bit more autobiographical in nature. So you are a prolific scholar. You have trained generations of scholars and inspired many. So how did you get to be the scholar you are, and what inspired you to become a scholar of Islamic studies?
I think the formative experience of being in the Peace Corps in Tunisia from 1972 to 1975 grounded my interest in Arabic and Islamic culture and civilization. And it led me, after 3 years, to apply to graduate school in comparative literature. And at the University of Chicago, I came in contact with the writings of Ibn al-Arabi. I studied Quran with Professor Fazlur Rahman, and I studied Ibn al-Arabi with Professor Rahman. Although he's not known as a Sufi scholar, he deeply appreciated the works of Ibn al-Arabi. And I studied classical Arabic poetry there, particularly pre-Islamic poetry. And that nexus of interests gradually formed my interest in, among other things, Tarjuman al-Ashwaq, which I translate in my new book as The Translator of Desires. So that would be the core beginning of an interest of several interests that continued throughout my life.
This is a fantastic and amazing translation, and I'm sure many people are very interested to be able to sit with these poems. I wonder if you could say a little bit about what the translation process was like for you. Where did you get the sources? I imagine there were probably challenges, but I'm sure there were also some very exciting or joyful moments in the process of translating. So can you share a little bit of that with us?
Certainly. Early on, as early as 1995, I began translating certain poems from the Tarjuman. And each translation went through, of course, multiple drafts. And in the process, once the translation was finished and published, multiple readings in front of audiences, and all those audiences contributed to the development of a style that I hope would bring across the vitality and urgency and visionary quality of these poems. I should note that the poems are not, at first sight, Sufi poems. In fact, I don't think that if we didn't know the author, we would necessarily categorize them as Sufi poems. Rather, I came to believe that they were generative of Ibn al-Arabi's later Sufi thought. He composed these poems of shauq, or longing, and it's that deep sense of longing, longing as an infinite force, an infinite force that is seen in his notion that there's two kinds of longing, longing for that which is past or distant, and longing for that which is present or near. And longing is something that becomes a primal force in his poetry and in his mystical philosophy, as shown later in his later works, in his writings on love and his writings on longing as a cosmic force, generative, in fact, of creation of the universe and the return to God. Among the several problems that are endemic to translation from classical Arabic poetry, of course, is the fact that English, contemporary English, does not easily rhyme, especially rhyming at the end of each verse, which classical Arabic poetry does. Nor do we have the strict set of meters, about 12 meters, that Ibn Arabi used from the classical repertoire. And so how do you compensate for these key elements that keep a pulse in the poem, that keep the poem alive? And I tried to do that by recreating the effect of rhyme and of meter in another format, a format that would use shorter lines and use line breaks to recall the play against of syntax against meter, the tension and release, the dance of tension and release that forms the heart of classical Arabic rhymed and metrical poetry.
What did you enjoy most about translating these poems?
I would say with each draft, with each new translation, understanding the poem a little better. That is, if you can't make a poem come alive in a certain way, to go more deeply into its heart and to see what it's what the deep heart of that poem is doing, and then to put oneself in the place of how would we say that in contemporary English poetry.
It's definitely felt, or I felt it as I was reading the poems and your translations of the poems and in the English version, at least. I'm very fascinated by this idea that Ibn Arabi, you raise this in the introduction or the preface to the book, that he wasn't a Sufi poet. And I guess people have many understandings of Ibn Arabi. He's perhaps a provocative or controversial figure, however you want to think of him. So perhaps for our listeners who may not know him too well, what would you want folks to know about this figure before entering into this realm of poems? And then perhaps we could talk a little bit about how we contextualize the Tarjuman within the broader works and, you know, the philosophical works that Ibn al-Arabi has produced subsequently.
Sure. Ibn al-Arabi was, of course, one of the most influential and controversial figures in Islamic civilization. A poet, a mystic, a muhaddith, a collector of hadith, the author of a vast number of works on various topics, whose influence is felt, has been felt around the world and continues today. Many controversies developed around him, one of which we'll discuss as part of the history of the Tarjuman al-Ashwaq itself. He was born in near Murcia in present-day Spain, in Andalus, in the year 1165 of the Common Era. And after he became a Sufi, he wandered throughout the Arabic West, Andalus and the Maghreb, present-day Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia, constantly moving in search of knowledge and in search of visionary and mystical encounters. And beginning his writings, he wrote a number of works during these periods. It was his Hajj at the midpoint of his life, in the year 1201-1202, 598 of the Common Era, that became a transformative moment in the rest of his life, and a transformative moment in leading up to the key works of his later period, the Tarjuman al-Ashwaq, which is very much centered on the Hajj, the Futuhat al-Makkiyah, his famous Summa, the vast work that begins with his encounter, his visionary encounter at the Hajj, an encounter that he says becomes, in fact, the subject matter for the entire work. And many of his other works, including his love poems to the Kaaba, which he composed after he had noted in the style of some Sufis that he had questioned why he was circumambulating stones which could not harm the human being or benefit the human being. And the Kaaba, replied by assaulting him, according to this his preface to this work. And he composed 12 love poems to the Kaaba in intricate rhymed prose. So that's a brief overview of Ibn al-Arabi. And by the time of his death in Damascus in 1240, 1240 CE, he had a large circle of followers, and he was well on his way to becoming known as Sheikh al-Akhbar, the Sheikh al-Akhbar, the Grand Master of Islamic mystical thought.
And there was controversy about this particular compilation of poetry, the Tarjuman, which you mentioned in the introduction. And I wonder if we could talk a little bit about that before we get into the poems itself. And namely, what was the controversy and why was there kind of this, court held and people testifying to the works against him?
As mentioned, if one reads these poems, they read as classical Arabic love poetry, the poetry of the Nasib, the first part of the Qasida, and of Ghazal more widely, with echoes of the Muashahat, a strophic form, although he doesn't employ that form in the Tarjuman. He employs many of the images and the tone and mood from some of the Muashahat. And they read, many of them are highly erotic, and many of them are playful. Some are solemn, some are ironic. Some are self-mocking. They have every facet of the lover's mood that one can have. And in one of his prefaces, he discussed how the inspiration for these poems was a young woman named Nizam, who has been compared by scholars to Beatrice, who was the inspiration for Dante's Divine Comedy. And he states that all these poems, regardless of how many different beloveds there are in the poems, are really poems about Nizam, but they're really also fundamentally poems about mystical encounters and spiritual ma'arif. Spiritual knowings, a kind of personal experiential knowledge of, in Sufi terms, of the divine. And a sheikh in Aleppo objected and said that he didn't read these poems as spiritual allegories, and he was wondering whether Ibn Arabi, a famous man of religion, just wanted to cover up the fact that he composed erotic Ghazal poetry by stating that they're really allegories for the mystical path to God. At that point, his followers urged him to respond. So he composed in a very quick period of time, just several weeks, a commentary on the poem that linked the poems to mystical psychology and to the mystic path and to his mystical cosmology. And there was this sort of literary inquisition held in Aleppo that was chaired by the famous Syrian jurist and historian Ibn Adim, during which Ibn Adim read parts of this commentary. Now that commentary then had the effect of, it had several effects. Number one, it has been attached to the poems in a way that has often led attention away from the poems, to where the poems are basically ignored and the the mystical philosophy within the commentary is then projected back into the poems. My view of this is somewhat different. My view is that the poems themselves, this deep exploration of shalk, of longing and of love, love that in the poetry is not divided up according to divine or human, but is seen as a primal and cosmic force, a central driving force within human aspiration, that deep encounter with longing and love then was something that he reflected upon as he was working on his mystical philosophy. And in terms of the commentary, it was one of his first efforts, it seems, to map out his mystical thought and the shalk is at the heart of that. And one finds this throughout Sufi traditions that, and not just Sufi traditions, that love poetry is generative of thought more widely. There was a famous program in Persia, in Iran, by Dr. Gumshai, in which he would read poetry of Rumi and Hafiz, and then comment on philosophy, politics, society, and always go back and forth between reading the love poetry and engagement with the world. And I find that Ibn al-Arabi did that as well. In terms of historical terms, one comparison that can be made was the Christian mystic John of the Cross, who a century and a half or two centuries after Ibn al-Arabi composed a series of highly erotic love poetry. He was a Carmelite monk and then wrote an extensive mystical commentary on those poems called The Dark Night of the Soul. So those are some thoughts on the commentary. And the commentary also had the effect, the banned in Boston effect. Everybody used to want to have their book banned in Boston because then it would gain great notoriety and sell more copies. And Ibn Arabi's trial certainly brought much attention to the Tarjuman al-Ashwaq. But as I mentioned, it also tended to obscure the poems themselves. And my effort has been an effort to retrieve the passion, the visionary quality, and the poetic quality of those poems.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
That's so fascinating. It's interesting that it's the way that there's like a PR effect, right, of what happened to the poems. But I think what you have done in terms of centering the poems is such an amazing gift. I don't know how else to frame it. But let's get into these poems. and talk a little bit about some of the themes that you've alluded to already in terms of longing, in terms of love, erotic imagery. One of the things I was really fascinated by as I was reading them is kind of, I think how you describe kind of the flora and the fauna, or the geography, or the imagery of landscapes that he's evoking of nature. I don't know if this was something that was on your mind as you were reading it, but this really stood out for me. So can you say a little bit about this, of what is he drawing from in terms of nature? Perhaps what is the significance of that within the context of Sufism for him, maybe?
I'll read a couple poems later that illustrate this. Ibn Arabi's poems are filled with place names, for example, and these place names are often associated with stations of the lost beloved. So in the classical Arabic poetic tradition, the poet at the beginning of the poem comes across an abandoned camp or an abandoned dwelling, and when at a certain moment recognizes that this is not just any abandoned camp or any dwelling, but it's the abandoned camp of his beloved, either usually the camp of his beloved in her journey away from the poet the last time they were together. And this moment of realization, where these traces in the sand and burned hearthstones, etc., emerge into focus as the sign of the lost beloved, provoke the power of the poetic voice. And out of that encounter with these ruins, the Atlal, the poet's voice comes forth in a powerful way. And often there'll be many stations of the beloved. So there'll be the encounter with the Atlal, and then the poet will recall the beloved's other stations that she passed in her journey away from him. And in many cases, the poet, of course, it was not there. He could not see her in these stations. So in many cases, it's a projection of the poet still with the beloved. And in some of these poems that we'll be reading, one can see that psychological tension drawn to a very tight, almost a snap, where the poet is standing at the ruins of an abandoned campsite, and yet part of him is still with the beloved, following her as she moves from camp to camp. What Ibn al-Arabi then did with these stations was, following a tradition that we can mention that goes back about a couple hundred years, began associating the stations of the lost beloved with the stations of the traveler on the way to the Hajj. So in many of these poems, we'll have classical stations of the lost beloved, as well as the stations along the pilgrimage trail from Baghdad to Mecca, such as Hajar, one of the stations that appears throughout the Tarjuman. Let's talk about the flora and the fauna a little bit later. I thought maybe we could take a look at a couple poems and explore some of the issues there.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay.
Yeah. Maybe we can get the reference in case listeners have the text with them and they could follow along.
Yes. So we'll start with a very short and a deceptively simple poem, number one in the Tarjuman. I will read it first in Arabic and then in English. ليت شعري هل درع أي قلب ملكو وفوادي لو درع أي شعب سلكو أتراهم سلموا أم تراهم هلكوا حار أرباب الهوى في الهوى وتبكوا bewildered. I wish I knew if they knew whose heart they've taken, or my heart knew which high ridge track they follow. Do you see them safe or perishing? The lords of love are in love, ensnared, bewildered. This very apparently simple poem, for those unfamiliar with Arabic poetry, it's worth noting that the they here would be recognized in the Arabic poetic tradition as the poet thinking about the beloved and the other women that traveled with her in their journey away from the poet. And what the poems in the Tarjuman do in a particularly radical way is continually shift between the beloved as singular and the beloved as beloveds as plural. The way that works is, since the beloved is surrounded by her entourage, her retinue, the poet can refer to the retinue as plural, as is here, but it also serves as a metonymy for the beloved. He states in his prefatory work that he recited this poem. This poem came to his mind. He doesn't claim authorship. It just came into his mind once when he was circumambulating the Kaaba. So he withdrew away from the central area so he wouldn't bother the pilgrims there. And he recited these verses. And then he states that he felt a hand as soft as silk on his back, and he turned around, and there was a young woman there, a Jariya, technically a slave or a freed slave, who proceeded to critique each of the four verses in quite a rigorous fashion, really tearing them apart. And at the end, she exclaimed that how could any poet say, refer to being bewilderment and love, when true love causes the annihilation of the self, and therefore there's no self left to be bewildered. And this is this Jariya who appeared there. Was later, was often associated with Nizam, the young woman that he met in Mecca. Although Nizam is said to have been of pure Persian origin from Isfahan, the Jariya was said to be from among the Rum, a term that could be used for Anatolians like Rumi. In Ibn Arabi, probably more likely meant from a Christian background. One thing to mention about the intertextuality of the poems and of the prefatory material that Ibn Arabi added to them, what I call the romance of the Tarjuman, the material about Tarjuman and this Jariya, who doesn't give her name, but says she can be called Qurrat al-Ayn, the cooling or the solace of the eye, that it reflects a motif that Ibn Arabi explored in another one of his works, which has been almost ignored in modern scholarship, a work called Muhadarat al-Abrar, The Sessions of the Righteous, which is a belletristic work in which he presents several stories of Jariyas, humble women at the Kaaba, who encounter great Sufis like Junaid or others, and there's a kind of intellectual and spiritual joust between the two figures, in which ultimately the humble Jariya teaches the famous sheikh something vital about love and about sincerity. So these motifs he was exploring in this belletristic work, and here we can see this motif within his own visionary experience. And it shows, I think, the relationship between being immersed in a whole literary tradition of a certain spiritual encounter at the Kaaba and his own encounters at the Kaaba as he relates them in his preface.
That's so fascinating. And yeah, there's so much here that you would really have to sit and process, as you say, right? It's deceptive in terms of what it's getting out. Can you say a little bit, before we go to another poem, a little bit about the feminine? I found throughout all the poems, there's 61 in total, that the feminine is evoked quite often, either in a specific person, as you're speaking about in this particular poem, or in the figure of the Nizam, or kind of broadly. There are times when a masculine tendency is evoked, especially in terms of longing or love, but the beloved tends to be, at least my understanding of it was that it was feminine.
Yes, it's mostly feminine. Coming out of the classical Arabic tradition, the pre-Islamic tradition, the poet was voiced as male and the beloved is female. Within the Andalusian tradition and the tradition in Baghdad of the medieval period, you have many more instances of the male beloved appearing. But in these poems, yes, it is primarily the female beloved. And I'd like to explore the female beloved in a particular poem that I think really brings out the power of it. Now, these poems can be read in a non-Sufi way, and they can be read in a Sufi way. Of course, if they're read in a Sufi way, the feminine figure would be the divine or the divine manifestation. Let's take a look at poem 24. Now, here's a poem that centers around one of the stations of the beloved, a station known as Lala. In this poem, is mourning the beloved at the station of Lala. And then after three verses, there's a transformation where the poet is actually engaged in a dialogue with a feminine figure. And that feminine figure could be the beloved, could be the station itself, or it could be the moringa tree. The moringa tree, Alban in Arabic, is a central theme and symbol in Ibn Arabi's poetry. It's a beautiful tree with delicate leaves and pinkish flowers. But a very strong trunk that can stand out radically in the desert, often growing out of rock outcroppings. And it's a symbol in Ibn al-Arabi for union with the beloved, for beauty, and for the times in the past when the poet and the beloved were together. So I'll read this poem in English. Stay at the ruins in Lalai fading, and in that wilderness grieve for those we loved. And at that campsite, call out her name, your heart softly torn away. Oh, for the times passed near her moringa, picking her fruit, her garden's red rose. All who sought you, you showered with graces. Only for me did your lightning flash faceless. We used, she said, to come there together in my branches' shadows in that lush land. My lightning, once of smiles flash, is now a blaze of barren stone. Blame time, relentless time. What fault was it of Lalai? I forgave her as I heard her speak, grieving as I grieved with a wounded heart. I asked her when I saw her meadows, pastures now of the scouring winds. Did they tell you where they'd rest at noon? Yes, she said, at Sand Hill, where white tents glow from the light of all those suns ablaze within. So this is a poem that one of the more grieving poems, a poem in which the emotion reaches a peak when the poet, as often, seems to be blaming the beloved or the station of Lalai, the sign of the beloved, for the loss and for the separation, and where the feminine voice speaks back to the poet, and they engage in this dialogue where they each share their grief.
This is probably one of my favorite. I mean, there's so many poems in here that I loved, but I remember this when I first read it, just because it felt like it brought together so many of the imagery found across the poems. And again, I think the evoking of the tree, the moringa, also was stood out to me as well when I read it. This one's a beautiful one.
Another set of issues that we would want to explore, which is really at the core of these poems, are the issues concerning the Hajj, the way that erotic love poetry became associated with the Hajj in these poems, and the traditions that association draws upon. So for an example of that, I'd like us to go to poem 7. And for those who might be following along, if you have the book, that'd be on page 24 and 25. Gowns of Dark. This poem will bring up central stations within the Hajj, Mina, the height of Ram, which is said to have been near Mecca in some of Ibn Arabi's interpretations, Jem, which is a word also for Muzdalifa, where the mass of pilgrims come together at one place, and the Arafah plain, where, of course, pilgrims stand throughout the afternoon. I touched the stone through a whirl of young women circling the Kaaba, faces veiled. They lowered their veils, revealing the sun. Death stalks the gaze, they warned. Many's the proud soul we've taken questing at the threshold of Mina's cairns, in the Wadi courts near the heights of Ram and Jem, through the throngs on Arafah plain. See how beauty plunders the chaste, spoiler of virtue, so aptly named. We'll meet at Zumzum after the circling by the middle tent near the boulders. There a man starved by love's fever is cured by the scent of those who lured him. Aroused, they loosen their hair and let it fall, enfolding themselves in dark. So before I mention anything about this poem, I just wondered if you wanted to have any comments on how it struck you.
So much of the poetry, and even in this one, I remember the last bit of the hair and the curls of the hair. There's just such an intimacy in them, I remember when reading it, and it shows kind of you know, the way in which you would think of the beloved or beloved's hair and then the longing of it. And so I know I'm kind of rambling, but it's the intimacy that I'm often struck by when I'm reading the poems, right? And especially as you're saying this sense of longing. And for this to be happening at the Kaaba, like, I wonder if we could talk about that. Like, what is the significance of that, right? But
yes, absolutely. The notion of intimacy associated with dark, and especially with the dark of the beloved's hair, appears in many of these poems. And it's often contrasted with the glare and heat of the sun. The glare and heat of the sun, we saw something reminiscent of that, where these beloved figures actually turn more into siren figures or fearsome figures early in the poem, where they say, "Death is in the gaze," they warned. So gazing at directly at the beloved, gazing at in these poems, like gazing directly into the sun. It's too much to be taken in. And so you have a dialectic between dark and light throughout the poem, where dark or black is associated with intimacy, depth, solace, comfort, and the glare of light is associated with overwhelmingly powerful experience. And the two go together. Of course, one doesn't achieve the intimacy without the powerful experience in these poems. Now, this poem, of course, if one read it, it is quite provocative. These figures are these houri-like figures, figures reminiscent of the dark-eyed maidens in the Quran, and the poet are seemingly making a rendezvous at the Kaaba. And so let's go back into some of the traditions that this kind of poetry grows out of. Although I think in Ibn Arabi intensifies these traditions in a very particular way. In his work, Muhadarat al-Abrar, that I mentioned, Sessions of the Righteous, when he talks about these young women at the Kaaba encountering Sufi sages, in many ways, the encounter begins with the Sufi sage or the another sheikh figure hearing a woman reciting love poetry at the Kaaba, and either remonstrating with her beloved that she's separate, or expressing hope that the beloved will always be with her. And in some cases, the sage will say, "How could you be saying something like this and at a place like this?" And then the woman will respond, often with verses of poetry, sometimes with verses of poetry, and they'll go back and forth. In many of these stories, some of which are taken from traditions that were passed on by a Hanbalite Sufi in Baghdad jurist by the name of Ibn al-Jawzi, in one of his works, in many cases, the sage will pass out in realizing the truth that the Jariya taught. It also within Muhadarat al-Abrar, and also within the works of Ibn al-Jawzi, there are references to many, many poems by two earlier poets, Sharif al-Radi and Mihyar al-Daylami. These were Shiite major Shiite figures in Baghdad, and each of them, first Sharif Aradi and then later Mihyar, led the official pilgrimage to the Hajj annually from Baghdad. And many of their nasibs included references to the stations along the Hajj and to the stations within the Hajj. And so this tradition of linking erotic poetry with the Hajj had been developed over the past two centuries. And in one of Ibn al-Jawzi's works that Ibn Arabi cites, Ibn al-Jawzi explicitly sets out to link erotic longing with the Hajj. The work is called Muthir al-Gharam al-Sakin ila Aqdas al-Makan, inciting passion for the holiest places. The notion that the Hajj is a place of the deepest longing and passion is there. And in many cases, in Ibn al-Arabi's poetry, this is brought into a very heightened manner of portrayal. The poet is often at the Hajj as close as any human being can get to the beloved, and yet still separated. Those who cling to the wall of the Kaaba are getting as close as they can to God. But of course, the Kaaba does not contain God in any of the idolatry senses of the word. So it is a moment of deep poignancy that Ibn al-Arabi tries to bring out.
And then it so seems that the entire kind of the scope of the poems are really then reflective of the journey of the Sufi. We take a Sufi reading of it from the stations to kind of the traveling to getting to the Kaaba and the longing. So it just kind of presents the whole process of what the Sufi ultimately would go through on the spiritual journey, which brings us back to kind of what the first poem that you read us was saying, that how could you still be bewildered if there is an I that is bewildering?
Yes, and one will notice throughout these poems that many of the poems have death within the middle of them. So here we have death is in the gaze they warned. And this death in many of them, in some of them is, not all of them, but in some of them is framed in the language of fana, or the death of the ego self in union with the divine beloved. It is this, and that becomes the transformative moment in the poems, the key moment around which the poems turn. Another thing that struck me here is this poem and others that in many cases explicitly evoke the Huris of the Quran. Of course, the Huris of the Quran are in paradise. So they're getting close to the Kaaba is symbolically not only getting close to God, but it's also symbolically getting close to the garden of the afterlife. So it's as if the Huris here, who could be seen as temptresses in some readings, are actually beckoning from the other side of reality, beckoning from the Jannah. So it brings together, as the poems throughout the Tarjuman do, brings together erotic longing with all the aspects of core Islamic practice and ritual.
There's just so much here and so much we could talk about. And you've kind of really given us
you know, in your guidance through the three poems, like a mini masterclass of how to approach these poems. Do you have any advice for perhaps, you know, be it lay readers who are picking up this book of Ibn al-Arabi's poems for the first time and how they should approach it? And perhaps a lot of our listeners are also educators who teach at university. So maybe they're teaching courses on Sufism. Do you have any advice for those folks who may want to incorporate some of this into their courses of how to do that and how to teach it, like you've done for us, you've modeled it for us now?
I think this course would work in classes devoted to Arabic poetry, Arabic civilization, or Sufism. As I mentioned, it's a the relation with Sufism is subtle in these poems. And I do not read the poems directly through the mystical commentary because that the mystical, had I translated the mystical commentary, the book would have been three times as large. And the mystical commentary in many ways is not easily translatable, if at all, because Ibn Arabi is constantly playing with root etymological roots. In English, you can't get those unless you put the Arabic words in parenthesis and explain the verbal play that's going on there. But those, what is emerging in the mystical commentary, but is not fully developed yet, is what is found in Ibn Arabi's later masterworks, the Futuhat al-Makkiyah, the Meccan openings, as well as his Fusus al-Hikam, the Ring Stones of Wisdom. In fact, the last chapter of the Ring Stones of Wisdom is a chapter about love. It's the chapter on Muhammad. And it begins with how three things were dear to Muhammad, women, prayer, and perfume. And it takes that and ultimately develops this notion of a cosmic love. Love is a cosmic force, and longing for the creation to be known, for the creator to be known, and longing for the creature to know the creator, and to longing for the creature to exist. That is clearly one of the culminations of Ibn Arabi's thinking on love. So if I were to teach this work, this book, in connection to Sufism, I would definitely want to read sections of the Muhammad chapter of Fusus al-Hikam, the Ring Settings of Wisdom, and as well as the two chapters in the Futuhat al-Makkiyah on Ma'rifah and on love. Those are chapters, I think it's 366 and 367. I mention it in the notes to the poems. Very recently, a full translation of the Futuhat has come out, and that can be a useful aid to reading those. And I think Ibn Arabi's chapter in the Futuhat al-Makkiyah on love is extraordinarily powerful. And some of the verses in the Tarjuman al-Ashwaq are in that chapter. So to put that chapter with some of these poems, I think would really show the way the love poetry connects to Ibn Arabi's mystical thought more widely. One thing I also notice mention about Arabic poetry is one might say that there is a mystical or proto-mystical element in the most intense love poetry, just as intense love poetry. Because when the poet goes mad with love, as as is the case in many of these poems, and starts raving, and where opposites come together. The poet is here, the beloved is here, but gone. The poet is schizophrenic, part of him is here, but part of him, he says, is with the beloved, howling on her trail as she moves away from the poet, even guiding her from place to place. These contradictions, the poet is burned in his sighs, lost in the glow within her eyes. The way that agony and ecstasy come together, nearness and farness, they can be seen as transcending the bounds of normal human logic in a way that Sufism does. And of course, Sufis were aware of this, and it's one of the reasons they often incorporated classical Arab poems, not necessarily considered Sufi poems, into their writings.
That's very helpful. And I think I'm sure our listeners very much would want to try that out in the classes that they're teaching as well. Before we conclude, I've taken up so much of your time and you've been very generous with it. Is there anything else that you'd want our listeners in terms to keep in mind or take away as we step back and look at the broader project?
Yes, I'd like to read just five verses of another poem and briefly comment on them. This is the most famous poem in the Tarjuman al-Ishwaq, poem number 11, and it's on. It begins on pages 36 and 37. I'll read some Arabic and then some English. Allah ya hamamat al-arakati wal-bani tarafakna la tudifna bishajwi ashjani. طرفقنا لا تظهرنا بالناخ والبكاء خفية صبباتي ومقنونة أحزاني أطارخها عند الأصيل وبالدخاء بخنتي مشتاق وأنتي حيماني تناوحت الأرواح في غيدة الغدا ومالت بأفنان علي وأفناني وجاءت من الشوق المبرح والجوى ومن طرف البلوى إلي بأفنان. Gentle now, doves. Gentle now, doves of the sprigberry and moringa. Don't add sighs to my heartache. Gentle now, lest your sad cooing show the love I hide, the sorrow I seal. In the evening I echo back. In the morning, echo the longing of the lovesick and lost. Spirits moan in the gada trees, bending branches over me as I pass away, bringing yearning, heartbreak, and ever new twists of pain to try me. So this is the poem that ends with the famous verses, I profess the religion of love. It's camel's turn. There lives my faith. Adinu bidin al hubbi anna tawajahat raka'ibhu adinu dini wa imani. And yet, those verses are often taken out of context from the poem and from Tarjuman more widely. And they deserve to be among the most widely quoted verses in Arabic poetry, but the poem itself is what allows them their richness and their depth. So here we see the theme of the poet and the doves mourning together here near the moringa and the arak, which I translate here as sprigberry. The poet, being broken out of his attempt to hide his love. And then in verse 4, we have this transformative experience. Spirits moan in the gada trees, bending branches over me as I pass away. Here is a clear reference to Fana. And it's after this reference to Fana that the poem transforms itself and transforms the entire notion of the Kaaba in the Tarjuman, when later on in the poem, Ibn Arabi says, "Hour by hour they circle my heart in rapture and touch my corners with a kiss." So here, the poet, instead of circumambulating the Kaaba, or instead of following after the beloved, here the poet's heart becomes the still center of movement, and these beloved figures are circumambulating the Kaaba of the human heart. And it's only after these experiences that Ibn Arabi declares his religion of love. And that shows how the religion of love is not just a sentimental notion of religion as being one of love, but it's thickly grounded within the ritual practice of Islam, the various mystical theologies within Islam, the hadith traditions within Islam that form many of the motifs within these poems.
Yeah, I think that's so helpful to know, and the content that you provided for us as well.
Thank you so very much for your thoughtful reading of these poems and for inviting me on this program. It's been a great pleasure.
Oh, the pleasure has been completely mine. It's been a very special treat, and I could listen to you forever, and I'm sure our listeners feel the same way. Dr. Michael Sells, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
And that was my conversation with Dr. Michael Sells about his translation of Muhyiddin Ibn al-Arabi's poems, The Translator of Desires. I hope you enjoyed the conversation, and I hope you'll join us again next time. Until then, stay well and safe.